of knowing.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is episode 579. Jason Lindgren is with me, just the two of us today, and we're going to cover the history of electric cars, which is pretty topical considering, I don't know, you might even call this the age of electricity. Electricity is becoming the big deal for everything. And in terms of the one world takeover efforts, electricity is on top simply because it allows so much control and tracking and data collection. I think it was a year or two ago that I heard in the state I'm in, they secretly or quietly slid in kill switches. And that's not just electric cars. That's on all the modern cars with computers in them or numbers of computers. But anyhow, welcome, Jason.
Oh, and a beautiful hot day it is.
So I actually have, let's see, we're recording this on May 9. On the 7th, I had my first actual, what I consider a full day of shooting. I shot all the way to Meridian, or basically noon, and then I had to reset my scope because once it goes by the high point, there's things you got to do with a telescope. And it's a whole new world. The days of analog are behind us. Everything is so technical now. And filming the sun is, at least in my view, far more difficult than filming at night. But we're going to start seeing content come out. The only issue is I've been waiting since March, and I've had, I think, officially 5 days, and the other four were partial at best. And when I filmed on the 7th, that night, chemtrails lined the sky more than I've seen in as long as I can remember, 50 or 60 of them going east and west, all the way from the southern sky to the northern sky. That was the day before yesterday. Last night, me and my wife were sitting here and hail just exploded the size of maybe golf balls or something. Like, I've never seen it here. And then rain poured. My friend in Michigan said there were tornadoes there. Pretty sure everyone's aware of what happened in Dubai. They're going ham on the weather modification. But anyhow, getting back to the scope, I hope to be producing a lot more content if the weather permits.
So I know a couple of people were challenging that it was fake and saying stupid things like it's CGI and all that, who I told off because, like, this isn't a NASA photo. This is the guy who filmed the lunar wave putting this stuff out. So why would he be putting out fake stuff? But what is the difference? Why would people who might see this think something like that?
Well, you know something, in this age where nobody trusts anything, I mean, it is a little paranoid, but I can't blame them all the way. In this next video, which will probably almost certainly be out by the time this episode comes out, I am going to address that. I am going to show in the video what footage looks coming straight out of the scope. And I shouldn't say out of the scope. The scope is analog. It's just filters and lenses. There's no digital anything with the light. It gets collected like if I had your smartphone or DSLR, anything with a camera chip in it. That's basically how it's being recorded. But I am recording it in grayscale. The reason I'm recording in grayscale is because you get, I don't know, literally like hundreds of millions of more shades. It's, I don't know if that's the right number, but it is significantly more shades. Then after the fact, after I've processed it, I put color on it. So I literally choose usually an orange. And the only reason I do that is because it helps our eye identify and be able to explore better. At least that's my point of view. In this video, I will show the videos before they're processed. I will show them as I'm processing. But you've got to realize there is nothing other than the color that is not in the data I collected. Now, I am processing it. So like if you took an image and sharpened it, I am doing that at a subtle level. But I'm not adding any data other than color. I am absolutely adding the color. If you see color, I added it. And that's true for the solar work. And to some degree, when I do the nighttime shooting, I'll explain it then. But cut to the chase, in this next video that goes up, number two, four members under the video link, I'll do my best to show what you actually see with an eyepiece or with a camera on the scope and how it gets to that finished product.
All right. Well, you ready to do this?
Yeah, let's get electrical.
Electric cars and vehicles have actually been around a lot longer than many might think, and certainly a lot longer than the current crop of mass-produced vehicles like Tesla's or even the General Motors EV1 that had been released in the late 1990s. Electric cars appeared quite a long time before the internal combustion engine-equipped sort, and those who have dreamed of making them function efficiently have never stopped trying to make them work, both on the road and as a legitimate business.
So I'm going to take a little bit of umbrage with that last sentence. It is my point of view that if people had not been everyone's familiar with what happened to Tesla. If that kind of thing didn't happen, regardless of whether you think he was a character or an individual, you know the story. If that kind of thing didn't go on in our world and ingenuity and inventions were fostered and nurtured, we would be in front of where we are now, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 years behind us. If you go back and look at the electric tech that was suppressed, even something as simple as the Tesla device that Clive has shown us so greatly, but also even compressed air. If you go back to the Victorian era and look what they were pulling off with compressed air, it's mind-boggling. So the point I would make here is the oil folk or the folk who control things absolutely put a stopper in the bottle every time any superior tech came around. As a matter of fact, we could have had cars running on water, and this is not a guess, at least from the 70s. I think the first time I heard and have recently seen the people who did, I think it was the 70s, where they were developing engines that could run on water.
Well, I'm of the mind that, and we've discussed this before, of course, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there were people, Nikola Tesla being the best example, but there were others, who were kind of figuring out how things really do work in this universe. And then the robber barons and the big banks and all that got involved and skewed things away from that to give us the system we have today, which is, of course, enforced scarcity.
Yes, it's all about control. And I'll be blunt. I am of a mind that dark forces have come to the fore in our era. I suspect that this goes on in every age, but unfortunately in our age, they seem to have a little more traction than they have at other times that I'm mildly aware of. Here's the thing. We had people in the 1800s that were educated far more thoroughly than we are educated now. And people might second guess that or take a problem with it, but here's the thing. We have been so led astray and so led into fantasy-based reality that even our math is accepted by the majority of us as legit when it's not. It's a put-up. It's a control system. It uses thing that cannot be shown, reflected, or proven in nature. If you go back to the 1800s, they were much closer to the realities shown in nature. And that's why we see just so many amazing things that came to the fore back then. But there is a dark shadow of some sort. I'm not going to give it a name. And they are mightily doing all they can do to prevent human beings from recognizing who we are and the potential that we actually have.
Electric cars were introduced in the late 1800s, quickly gaining popularity and becoming quite common in the early 1900s. It is said that by the turn of the 20th century, that there were almost twice as many electric cars on the road as were gasoline vehicles. At that time, electric cars were touted as a cleaner and more efficient choice in a vehicle compared to their gasoline-powered counterparts. Electric vehicles were also quieter, smoother, and easier to operate, which is said to have made them popular among women. During the early 1900s, electric cars are said to have been the preferred choice of several well-known individuals, such as Thomas Edison, John D. Rockefeller Jr., and Henry Ford's wife, Clara, all said to have been driving vehicles from the Detroit Electric Car Company. However, all of this would change within 20 years, with electric cars being wiped off the roads.
Well, you know, and even if you shift all the way up into the 80s, what's that movie, Jason? I think it's called Who Killed the Electric Car? So this is not just going on back then. This is recurrent, what we're talking about. But consider this. Was there a serious, like it appeared that there was a serious effort to put forward the electric car. And a big part of it was, oh, the global warming is going to kill us all and this is cleaner. Well, that's not even true. The electricity that drives them, many people have done the work to show it. It's just not true. It's as dirtier than anything else. And that doesn't even start to talk about the manufacturing of batteries. But here's my point. I think, I don't remember, was it Ford or one of the big car companies recently, I think, said they're not even going to make electric cars. But when you look at the infrastructure that was supposedly going to back up the big push for these electric cars, it's laughable. And people who did the math began to realize that the expense in certain conditions was off the chart. So it's almost like that now they're acting like they're going to put the electric car forward, but there's another agenda because the infrastructure and the cost and the business model, it's not serious. It's just not serious. It doesn't add up.
Yeah, it's Ford. They're pivoting away from EVs and making a much stronger move towards hybrids.
Yeah. You know, so what's that mean? You know, you're bad mouthing gas and then you're saying, well, we'll use 50% gas or whatever they want to say. My neighbor got, is it a Bolt or a Volt? I think it's a Bolt. It's not a very big car.
Chevy
Volt. It takes him all damn night to charge his car and his range is 150 miles. If he wants to get home, you know, you can get roughly 150 miles away if you want to make it back home. And as I looked into this, it was claimed that if you wanted to spend $800,000 on a car, you could get one that charges in 15 minutes. So again, we see absolute control being exerted over this tech that they're acting like is the savior for our environment and everything else. What's actually going on is there's other agendas. And all the agendas have to do with control. And everybody knows this now. And so, you know, add one and one. What is the actual agenda? Is it to get us on electric cars? Or is it somehow perversely connected to the efforts to control everyone everywhere?
The thing that is needed to make any electric vehicle function is some sort of battery setup. The modern usage of the term battery comes from Benjamin Franklin in 1749 while doing experiments with what were called Leyden jar capacitors. He grouped multiple jars together and called them a battery after the military term of weapons functioning together. He was putting multiple jars together to get more available power upon discharge. The first electrochemical battery, which is along the lines of what is used today, was built by Italian physicist Alessandro Volta in the year 1800. It was called the Voltaic pile and was a stack of copper and zinc plates that were separated by brine-soaked paper discs. This method could produce a steady current of electricity for a considerable length of time. At the time, he did not understand that the voltage that was being produced was coming from chemical reactions. In his mind, he thought that he had discovered an inexhaustible source of electric energy, and that the corrosion effects he was witnessing were merely a nuisance, and as opposed to the consequences of the occurring reaction, which of course made it a very finite energy resource. While impressive for the time period, these early batteries were too inconsistent with their voltage fluctuations, and the first practical use cell came along in 1836, invented by British chemist John Frederick Daniel, and was called the Daniel cell. This style of battery saw widespread adoption as the industry standard and was used as a power source for the electrical telegraph networks that were becoming commonplace starting in the 1840s. Rechargeable batteries became available around 1859, which would greatly assist with the concept of electric-powered vehicles. Toward the end of the 19th century came the invention of dry cell batteries, which replaced the previous liquid electrolyte style with a paste, which made portable electrical devices possible by being considerably less fragile and much safer. Battery technology, of course, would keep improving from there.
So most people aren't old enough to remember when I was young, driving my first car, you would pull into a gas station, the attendant would come out, he'd do things like check your oil, check your tire pressure, and wait for it, check your liquid level in your battery and fill it up if it needed it. But let's back up a little bit here to what Jason was saying. You know, so I'm Thomas Edison and I'm in my lab inventing, and I come up with this amazing way to store electricity. So what do? I say, how can I associate this with military weaponry? Oh, there it is. I'll call it a battery, because that's a term for weapons functioning together. I'm just saying, words have meaning. Why would you go there? Why would that association ever been made? But also back in that time, they're dealing with copper and zinc plates. This is what I'm talking about. The education and the closeness to the creation that existed, you know, in the 1800s before. That's important for intelligence. As an example, if I want to look at the sun, I look for it in hydrogen alpha or calcium K or sodium. You see where I'm going here? What we're doing now is getting away from all those things with synthetic replacements. And I will maintain to the day I drop, anything synthetic is inferior to anything natural.
Moving back in time, we have Robert Anderson, a 19th century Scottish inventor. He created the first crude electric carriage in Scotland sometime between the years of 1832 and 1839. The carriage was powered by non-rechargeable primary power cells, or galvanic cells, early batteries that would have to be discarded after used. Another Scot named Robert Davidson of Aberdeen constructed a prototype electric locomotive in the year 1837. A bigger and better version that was demonstrated in 1841 could go 1.5 miles at 4 miles per hour while towing 6 tons, after which it needed new zinc acid batteries. This impressive performance alarmed railway workers quite greatly because they saw it as a threat to their jobs tending steam engines, which led them to destroy Robert Davidson's devil machine, which he had named Galvani.
So here it is again. You have a generation of people that are closer to nature, and what they perceive is an affront. Now, the source for this material is saying, oh, they were afraid from their jobs. But you can look at almost any period of time. The other night, I saw an old movie, which was about a father who grew up his life before there were cars, but his son is living right as cars come online. And they show that division of the people used to the horse, used to the natural way of doing things, and calling the car stinkers and all these other things. But here we are again. This is 1837, and they're going 1.5 miles at 4 miles per hour, and they're hauling 6 tons. If that would have been allowed to develop at any level, you know, where would we have been by the time I was born? Way ahead of where we are now. Stuck in fossil fuels, as they like to call them.
Since batteries that could be recharged came along in 1859, the electric car idea became more viable. Around the year 1884, an inventor named Thomas Parker helped deploy electric-powered trams and built prototype electric cars in England. By 1890, a Scotland-born chemist who lived in Des Moines, Iowa, named William Morrison, applied for a patent on the electric carriage he had built, possibly as early as 1887. This electric carriage appeared in a city parade in 1888, according to the newspaper The Des Moines Register. This conveyance had front-wheel drive, 4 horsepower, and a top speed of 20 miles per hour was reported. It used 24 battery cells that required to be recharged every 50 miles. William Morrison's self-propelled carriage was considered a sensation at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. Morrison was actually more interested in the batteries than in the mobility of a vehicle, but because of his achievement, he sparked the imagination of other inventors.
So let me get this straight. We're in the late 1800s. They can go 50 miles before they need to recharge, and my neighbor's going 150 before he's got to turn around and come home. So I'll be fair. It's claiming he has a range of 300, but then he has to charge. I mean, it's beyond 12 hours. He was talking to me about it. But let's back up a minute where they talked about patents. Ironically, I was watching some clips on the guys who invented things like the water engine and other things. And there was a common thread through all these guys who were suppressed, who had brilliant inventions, which were superior to the gas engine that they were threatening. What they said was, if you ever invent anything, do not patent it, because if it matters, you will lose it. And as I listened to this over and over again, it became clear that that's one of the ways they control new tech. They just have spies or monitor the patent office. But what do we know about Einstein? Where did he work in his early career? I'm just saying. So if it is true what these individuals put forward, we've all been taught that when we invent something cool, oh, well, you've got to protect it, or someone rich will just steal it from me. You've got to go patent it. And it turns out that's exactly how they, or one of the ways they've been controlling the tech, is waiting to see the patents pop up for things that might be what they don't want.
The first commercial EV effort was known as the Electrobat. It was invented by Pedro Salom and Henry G. Morris out of the city of Philadelphia, and adapted technology that existed from battery electric streetcars and boats. They received a patent for the Electrobat in 1894. At first, the Electrobat was quite heavy and slow, much like a trolley car. It even had steel tires and had to cart around 1,600 pounds of batteries. The Electrobat would evolve to using pneumatic tires and lighter materials so that by the year 1896, their rear steer carriages used two 1.1 kilowatt motors to move 25 miles with a top speed of 20 miles per hour. Electrobats, along with another electric vehicle that was first built in 1887 by Andrew Ryker, won a series of 5-mile sprint races against gasoline-powered Duryea automobiles in 1896. Morris and Salom incorporated that year and moved to start profiting from their invention. Having built a few electric, what were called hansom cabs, to compete with the horse-drawn vehicles that then served New York, they sold the idea to Isaac L. Rice, who incorporated the Electric Vehicle Company in the state of New Jersey. Rice then began to attract big money investors and partners. By the early 1900s, they had more than 600 electric cabs operating in New York, along with smaller fleets in Baltimore, Boston, and several other eastern cities. In New York, the downtime it took to recharge the vehicle's batteries had to be addressed, which was done so by converting an ice arena into a battery swapping station. It was set up so that the electric cab could drive in, swap out spent batteries with a charged set, and go back to work. It is said, however, that the company expanded too quickly and ran into unforeseen conflicts among investors and partners, with the whole taxi venture collapsing by 1907. EVC's battery supplier, which was one of the investors and partners, became what is still around today as Exide Technologies, still manufacturing batteries. Another manufacturing partner, Albert Augustus Pope, who was a gasoline car manufacturing pioneer, took the technology and applied a name from its thriving bicycle business, Columbia, to a run of cars for public sale. Columbia reached the 1,000 units built milestone well before the more well-known names of mass manufacturers in Detroit, Henry Ford and Ransom Olds, who put their names in the history books. The obstacles that Albert Augustus Pope faced in his efforts to bring quiet and clean-running electric cars to market foreshadowed the numerous challenges that later automakers would face.
Well, I can read between the lines. And so his bicycle business gets called Columbia. There's the tell. In my view, that makes him almost certainly part of the gang that would like to control things like this. And if we back up, they talk about this business with electric hansom cabs and all the benefits, but then suddenly they give us the excuse, but they ran into unforeseen conflicts and they expanded too quickly. These are issues that could be solved. It seems to me that what I see written here implies that somebody put the kibosh on it. So by the time I get down to Pope, who's naming things Columbia, I am suspicious that the powers that be put the brakes on this endeavor.
The Detroit Electric was an electric vehicle produced by the Anderson Electric Car Company in Detroit, Michigan. The company built 13,000 electric cars from 1907 to 1939. Anderson had previously been known as the Anderson Carriage Company up until 1911. They had been producing carriages and buggies since 1884. Production of the electric automobile which was powered by a rechargeable lead-acid battery, began in the year 1907. For an additional $600, an Edison nickel-iron battery was available from the years 1911 to 1916. The cars were advertised as reliably getting 80 miles per battery charge, although it was reported that in one test that a Detroit Electric ran 211.3 miles on a single charge. Top speed for the vehicle was only about 20 miles per hour, quite slow by today's standards, but this was considered adequate for driving within a city or a small town at that time. The Detroit Electric was mainly sold to women drivers and physicians, both of whom desired the dependable and immediate start of the car without the physically demanding hand cranking of the engine that was required with early internal combustion engine automobiles. Since electric vehicles were expensive, they were targeted at wealthier folks, with a statement of the car's refinement being subtly made to prospective buyers through its design, which included the first use of curved window glass in a production automobile, which was an expensive and complex feature to produce. The company's production was at its peak in the decade of the 1910s, selling around 1,000 to 2,000 cars a year. Towards the end of that decade, sales of the Detroit Electric were helped by the high price of gasoline during World War I. In 1920, the name of the Anderson Company was changed to the Detroit Electric Car Company as the car maker separated from the body business.
Well, the abbreviation for that would be DECC. So I'm just saying, we see that 33 fingerprint, we usually take a second look. But if we take this at face value, they're claiming in what, less than a decade, or is a little more than a decade, they've gone from 50 to 80 miles, but then they slip in that in a test, someone made it 211 miles on a single charge. So if any of that is true, there is real possibility here. So why did it stop? And again, it stopped because it's the same reason. It's basically the same reason light bulbs are the way they are. There was actually a light bulb mafia that met in Switzerland and said, you know what? We need to engineer all the light bulbs in the world so they fail, because our light bulbs are lasting too long. The quality is too good. It's a similar thing. You have powerful people come in, and this is why we know names like Firestone, the tire manufacturer. They put the kibosh on these things so they could control a market, and that market just happened to be the way people moved around the country. So in controlling the market, they have a direct influence over the entire population of the country.
Apart from individually owned and operated electric vehicles, public transportation also existed that started as animal-drawn carriages of various sorts, which moved through several technological changes through the decades of the 19th and into the 20th centuries. Trams and trolley cars of several sorts that had begun using horses or mules would change to steam-powered, gas-powered, and eventually to electric-powered. These would last for many years until the internal combustion engine bus would take over, beginning in the first decades of, but continuing on throughout the 20th century. In the United States, a handful of cities still have some sort of old-school urban transport system. These include Boston, Cleveland, New Orleans, Newark, Pittsburgh, and San Francisco. Of course, these remaining systems are considerably smaller than they once had been. Other cities, such as Norwalk and Washington, D.C., have actually reintroduced streetcars.
So there's so many obvious things on the face of it that we don't really look at. Why is it always true that there can only be one? So here we are talking about all this, and we talk about three methods: steam power, gas power, and electric power. Why does there only have to be gas? That should be our first tell. Why aren't there industries who capitalized and took steam as far as it could go? Some might argue they did, but you see my point here. Why is it that 90-something percent of all the vehicles in this country are on gas when there's all these other options available? And just up to the 1800s, we've shown the viability of electricity, and yet it was stomped out.
Well, the streetcars in New Orleans are definitely in regular use. I see them all the time and keep meaning to try them out just to do so.
You know, this reminds me, and I think you might have seen some of them. Fortune sent me these images of the subways before the turn of not just the previous century, coming out of the 1800s. And it's like it's better than a Ritz-Carlton hotel, showing me the train cars, the craftsmanship and the beauty and the architecture and the artistry of it. It's mind-boggling. And it always sticks with me because his comment was, you could have eaten a meal off the floor of the subways. And it's just another example of what's happened, how all these controls have been exerted to do basically what Jason was talking about. You know, there's not enough to go around and everything gets poorer quality and everything gets more controlled to where we are today. To this day and moving forward, anytime you see a corporation merge or get bought up, you are seeing the world pushing towards a one world, one corporation. Call it a government if you want.
Electric cars remained popular in the early 20th century until advances in the internal combustion engine cars, as well as mass production of less expensive gasoline, as well as diesel-powered vehicles, an excellent example of which is the Ford Model T, led to a stark decline. Internal combustion engine cars did not suffer from having to wait hours for a recharge, since all you had to do was fill the gas tank back up to continue using the vehicle. However, one could consider the real decisive moment had come when the electric starter motor was invented around 1911-1912 by Charles Kettering, which began to be regularly fitted to new production vehicles. This invention replaced the rather laborious hand-cranking method that previously had to be used to get an internal combustion engine started. With the price of gasoline falling considerably as well in this time period, this made the economic and convenience choice of which vehicle to purchase to go almost all in for the internal combustion engine car.
Can you imagine in the dead of winter in the east or northern states having to go out and try to hand crank an engine over when it's freezing outside? That seems like a pretty big hurdle to me. I guess people were tougher then, but I'm just saying.
Let's take a moment to discuss the Ford Model T, an automobile that was produced by the Ford Motor Company from October 1st, 1908 to May 26th, 1927. The Model T is generally considered to be the first mass affordable automobile, the result of which made car travel available to the ever-growing tier of middle-class Americans. The relatively low price of the vehicle was partly the result of Henry Ford's efficient fabrication capabilities, which included assembly line production as opposed to individual handcrafting. The savings that came from mass production allowed the price of the vehicle to decline from $780 in 1910 down to $290 in 1924, which is considered $4,952 in modern-day dollars. The Model T was mainly designed by three engineers and carried the nickname of the Tin Lizzie. The Ford Model T was, not surprisingly, named the most influential car of the 20th century in the 1999 Car of the Century competition. Over 15 million Model T cars are said to have been sold. This made it the most sold car in history before the Volkswagen Beetle claimed that title in 1972.
So this is one of the branches in the existence of modern culture, in a way, if you think about it. So what they're stating here is we got affordable. The way we did it is we went to mass production. We got efficient. But what that means is handcrafting and beauty are going to beginning to fall off. So is that a legitimate trade-off? And, you know, it's going to come down to individuals. You know, some individuals probably will say, I'd rather have that than that. And some will go the other way. But my point is when everything around us becomes mass produced, slowly that handcrafting, slowly that know-how, all of it falls off. And we get further and further into the kind of life we're leading now. But at the end of this, you mentioned the Tin Lizzie. I'm guessing, I don't know if you know, there's got to be a connection to the band, doesn't there? Isn't this, must be where it came from. I'll bet you.
Thin Lizzy? That's a good question. Despite the success of the Model T internal combustion engine car, Henry Ford was working on an electric model with his very good pal, Thomas Edison. Edison had been making significant advances in battery technology in the early years of the 20th century. He had encouraged his good buddy Henry Ford to pop off and start his gasoline-powered automotive company in 1903, but he also was denouncing them that same year, quoted as saying, "Electricity is the thing. There are no whirring and grinding gears with their numerous levers to confuse. There is not that almost terrifying, uncertain throb and whir of the powerful combustion engine. There's no water circulating system to get out of order, no dangerous and evil-smelling gasoline, and no noise." Despite Ford's success with internal combustion engine cars, he began working on an electric Edison Ford vehicle in the 1910s, which Ford wanted to produce as inexpensively as possible, much like his Model T. Edison was later quoted as saying, "I believe that ultimately the electric motor will be universally used for trucking in all large cities and that the electric automobile will be the family carriage of the future. All trucking must come to electricity. I am convinced that it will not be long before all the trucking in New York City will be electric." However, the technology just wasn't there yet as compared to internal combustion engine technology, and the project eventually fell through.
Can you imagine if it had happened? We all know now that you can grab electricity out of the air. We all know that if smart enough people were allowed to go down that road, that we could basically be living some version of the supposed Tesla dream. So if this had been allowed to transpire, how much longer would it have been before we were basically harvesting free energy, further separating ourselves from the controls of these men? I'm reasonably sure everyone listening comprehends that Edison was not a very nice man. There are plenty of stories of the horrible, horrible things he did to basically remain in control.
There were other developments that also contributed to the decline of the electric vehicle in the early 20th century. By the 1920s, the U.S. had a better system of roads that connected cities, which was getting better all the time, and this inspired Americans to want to get out and explore. There is also the discovery of Texas crude oil, which made gas to become quite inexpensive as well as readily available, even for rural Americans, and so gas filling stations began to pop up all across the country. On the electric side of things, very few Americans outside of the big cities had electricity at this point in time. This led to electric vehicles all but disappearing by the year 1935.
And this becomes a major spoke in the wheel of American culture. The car will be inseparable and in a lot of ways make this country unique, because not only is it manufacturing the best cars by the perception of the world, but we are going great distances very shortly. This is 1935.
Electric vehicles were now out of style, and gas-powered vehicles became the norm until the modern era. It is an interesting thing, however, to look at fuel efficiency, normally expressed in miles per gallon, or MPG. Henry Ford's Model T, which was released in 1908, could get 13 miles per gallon on the low end and could get up to 21 miles per gallon. It had a top speed of 42 miles per hour. However, other vehicles being released then and through the decades might not even get that much out of a gallon of gasoline. As the years went on, miles per gallon levels actually began to decline, although the engines were getting more efficient at getting more speed out of burning their fuel. In 1935, the average vehicle's fuel efficiency was at around 14 miles per gallon. This further dropped in the 1970s when vehicles plummeted to around the 12 miles per gallon mark, but were certainly capable of going faster than 42 miles per hour.
When I was a kid growing up, the big pickup trucks that used to be around, like a Harvester International or the Dodge, that I remember them getting about 8 miles to the gallon back in the day.
Well, that really sucks.
Well, that's what it was. But, you know, people don't realize how quickly all those muscle cars that everyone loves so much, they were not here for that long. If you go look up, you know, how quickly they came on the scene. And I'm talking about the classic muscle cars, you know, the GTOs, the Camaros, all these other cars. When we hit the 70s, the brakes were hit hard. And as everybody knows, the manufacturer oil crisis, what is that, 72? I don't remember. But two oil crises back to back were going to hit in the 70s, which relate directly to control because everybody at that point needs gasoline to get to their job or anything else in America.
Well, I think there is no expectation with a vehicle like a muscle car to get decent gas mileage. I'm sure the more tricked out the engine, the further that miles per gallon is plummeting.
Well, it's funny. So why were they, there was a point when they were just who could make the fastest production car, and they were doing it. And then all of a sudden, you know, as soon as you get into that new decade, it's the old, you know, Tavistocki, and each decade is going to be different. As soon as you get into the 70s, that's out of fashion. Now you need a catalytic converter. Now you need, you know, we're going to do the unleaded oil. All these changes they keep doing, which are basically reducing horsepower and other things. I don't know if this is true, but I thought I remembered when I was young that it was illegal for a production car to have something like more than three, maybe it was 400 horses. I don't know. But now some of those Hellcats and other things, those are like 800 horsepower.
Yeah, from what I recall, that became a bigger deal. Like even in the 80s, you could only have a car that would be considered street legal that could only do so much torque and all that because they didn't want it tearing up the roads.
You know, back in the day, as we pulled out of the 60s, you know, it was reflected in Hollywood. There was always a muscle car in the films, many of the films. And it was like part and parcel of the culture to get out on the freeways, go interstate, you know, go on long trips for vacations for families. It was just, it was part of the culture. And as the 70s rolled in, change came quick. I remember vividly the year when the first oil crisis had hit, and we were trying to go from San Diego to Rhode Island. And I think the first time it was, you had to have an odd or an even license plate on certain days to get gas. Then there were times when you could only fill up halfway. It was a whole thing, but we later found out it was like everything else in our world. It was manufactured. It was created.
As the Arab oil embargo started creating a worldwide shortage in the 1970s, fuel prices began to skyrocket and availability began to be an issue. This would lead to fuel economy being a large selling point for new vehicle designs. Even today, the average car isn't actually that much more fuel efficient than cars of yesteryear, although they certainly can hit far better top speeds. The average vehicle today has a range of between 20 and 30 miles per gallon, very similar to what was being seen in the 1920s. Part of this is because cars are quite a bit bigger these days. In 1982, the average car weighed in at around 3,000 pounds. By 2006, the average car was approximately 500 pounds heavier, with this figure continuing to rise depending on the style of vehicle, most especially with SUVs and trucks. There are numerous safety features as well as technological advances that play a big part in contributing to the weight of a modern vehicle, but certain modern insertions are said to improve fuel efficiency. Now, what is the actual truth to what sort of fuel efficiency that could be squeezed out of a modern internal combustion engine? Numerous stories have floated around about prototype vehicles that have insane gas mileage compared to production models, but it seems that keeping vehicles to very restricted fuel efficiency is another easy way to control the masses.
Well, in a way, we can detect the light bulb mafia idea in here, right? If you're going to say that from the 30s to the 80s, there's not a significant, you know, a big difference in how many miles per gallon. Maybe it is like the light bulb thing, right? They don't want a super efficient car because they're going to sell less gas. So they're going to make less money. Is that playing into this? And by the way, my family had direct knowledge of someone who had bought a car, pretty sure it was in the 70s. And there was a little device that nobody knew about. And she kept telling people that her car never ran out of gas. Eventually, this was confirmed and it was zeroed down to a little device that was, I think, near the carburetor. I don't remember. And then not long after that, the device came up missing. And this is direct knowledge, you know, our family to another family that we knew. So these possibilities existed. But I'm just saying, if they wanted to have gotten a car that ran on 100 miles a gallon, could they have done it? It seems like they probably could have. With the resources, or the story I just told wouldn't be true. So it's probably like the light bulb mafia.
And the last point for hour one, getting back to electric vehicles, they did see some use in post-war Japan, where access to gasoline was a struggle for several years. The Japanese government encouraged the production of electric vehicles for some time, and vehicles like electric taxis that could do about 20 miles per hour with a 40-mile range on lead-acid batteries went into use. Another common use came in the form of golf carts that began to be available in the 1950s. Other companies would make attempts to make electric vehicles throughout the mid-decades of the 20th century, but nothing ever came about to seriously compete with gasoline-powered cars.
You know, I laughed my butt off when I heard they were going to make a replica muscle car that was electric and actually put speakers in it so it sounded like a gas-burning car. That's real. They actually did that. But what's your sense of it, Jason? Do you feel like right now in the world that you see around you that electric cars are picking up or diminishing?
Everything I've seen as far as news articles is that they're diminishing. I don't see very many electric cars where I live. The only place I've been where I see a substantial amount of them, and that's mostly Teslas, is Southern California.
So what I have noticed is the pure, not hybrid, but the pure electric cars, the people who do that change their lifestyle. They commit to a certain distance and other things. So if you just happen to be a person that never really goes that far from home, or your work is not that far from home, it doesn't change the way you operate too much. But I mean, come on, man, 300-mile range, and then you got to charge for over 12 hours. I remember vividly turning 16 and a half, getting my license, having my first car. And in this country, that was a rite of passage. You were free. You could jump in your car and drive all the way across this country if you wanted. And the electric car is not that in the modern era. And I will never forget that. In my mind, the electric car is a form of control. It limits the freedoms that I knew when I was young and that I've enjoyed most of my life. And it also brings into play things like the kill switch I mentioned. But anything else you want to get into hour one, Jason?
Well, just to be fair, the infrastructure has gotten considerably more put in to charge electric vehicles around the country. You can do cross-country trips now. You just have to pre-plan for where you're going to stop to charge. And those charging stations are like, I think they call them like super stations or something to that effect, where you can get an 80% charge in like 45 minutes, I think. So while it's still not as good as filling up at the pump, it's considerably less annoying to deal with if it's something you want to do. But the reality is, even today, just like it was in the early 20th century, it's great for around town, but if you're going to be doing massive traveling, it's still going to have some obstacles that you have to overcome.
When I was in San Diego still, and it was a long time, but it must have been around 2007, we actually looked at electric car back then. I think it was a Honda Civic. And what stunned me was, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but the battery life was not that many years, nowhere near the life of the vehicle. And there was a charge to recycle them that was insane when you put the replacement in with them. So again, you're back to jumping through all these hoops to do this electric thing. And I don't know, do you know, I don't know that much about it directly other than what my neighbor tells me, but I'm assuming the battery life is longer. I did look at solar units for my house at one point, and I was told then a similar story. Here's the life of your batteries, and there is a significant charge in replacing them and recycling them. So I'm guessing that must be true of the electric vehicles that are being purchased today.
As I understand it, you get about 10 years out of them.
Yeah, that sets aside the explosions and fires and all the other things. But it is my point of view that they're not being serious about this, that there are other agendas about why we're doing this. I got a hedge trimmer that was electric because my old one that I had to plug in died, and it blew me away. I got home, I plugged it in, it charged for less than a half an hour, and the green light came on, and I went out and I used it for 6-7 hours during the course of the day. The next day I went out and used it again. I put it in the garage. There was so much rain that season that I had to trim everything twice. So I was thinking, oh, I've got to charge this thing. And I thought, oh, I'll just run it down. Well, I did a similar amount of work and didn't have to recharge it, put it away. Came back the next season, did the same thing again, not needing to charge that battery. And I was blown away. We're talking a hedge trimmer. That's real force. You know, you're cutting through small branches and stuff. And that's when it dawned on me that not only did this thing charge very quickly, it has lasted a ridiculous amount of time. And yet I don't see this in my neighbor's EV. I just don't. I mean, what do you think? Do you see where I'm going here?
I do. It seems like it's disproportional from the hand tool yes. to the vehicle. But the vehicles, to be fair, do compete with regular gas-powered cars as far as their pickup and speed. And actually, a lot of times, they're much faster. Like Teslas really are pretty fast cars, especially from the get-go. They really pick up speed very fast.
I was under the impression a gas-burning vehicle, like a regular gas-burning vehicle, doesn't touch an electric vehicle because all the energy is available instantaneously. I could be wrong because I'm not a gearhead, but I was under the impression that electric vehicles are much quicker than gas-burning cars.
That's what I mean. Your pickup from the get-go is pretty darn fast. And again, you're pushing a vehicle to do 50, 60, 70, even 80 miles per hour. I mean, some people drive pretty fast. That's a significant use of battery. So that's where you're seeing the depletion and not being able to compete for several hundred miles of charge. And range anxiety was the biggest problem. And as I said, I was quite surprised when I pulled up a map just how much infrastructure has been put in for these things. But again, you'd have to, if you're really going to do a cross-country trip, you have to plan it out so that you make sure you have stations to stop at.
I'll be blunt. To me, this is about control. To me, this is one of the facets of the world takeover to get to one world, whatever the hell you want to call it. To me, what's going on now is a far, far cry from the freedoms I knew when I was 16. Now you have a limited range. For some reason, my hedge trimmer is much more efficient and much more quickly to do everything and last longer, that it seems like that should be transferred. I have read where $800,000 cars have features similar to what I see in my not very good example hedge trimmer when we were comparing it to a vehicle. But here's my point. When we go electric and we see what's going on and there doesn't seem to be big improvement and huge extensions in the distance and shorter charge times, it looks to me like it's just part of the electric city idea where they are normalizing the idea that you can go 150 miles if you want to get home. Not 16-year-old crow where I can go as far as I want. Big difference there. And the idea of the 15-minute city and all these other things, I think what I suspect is true is this whole electric push for conveyance and vehicles is wrapped up in the limiting and limitation idea that is associated with what we know is going on around us.
All right. Well, when we get into hour two, we're going to continue throughout the mid-20th century and see the interesting devices that came about, not the least of which was the Moon Rover.
I didn't even think about that. No internal combustion engines on the moon, huh?
Well, I think they could have done it, but they didn't have very many gas stations available.
Yeah, it must have been a slight problem. Well, it would be a slight problem if I told you that you can fill up your car anywhere in the country, but it's going to take you 45 minutes to do it. Never mind 12 hours. But anyhow, that's hour one for episode 579. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is CROW777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episodes and access to the solar videos and the ability to stream the 2-hour film called Shoot the Moon that covers all my previous telescope work, mostly around the moon and nighttime sky and chemtrails. But with that, I would like to wish everybody a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era as we prep up for hour two. There it is, man. Cheers. We'll be right back.
is the enemy of knowing.